Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Al Shaheen. Mr. Sainer.
May it please the court, counsel, members of this court, my name is Nishay Sanin. I represent Raed Al Shaheen, and James Tunick represents his wife, Haifa Al Shaheen. Members of this court, just a brief synopsis of the facts which play an important factor in this case. This case was an undercover investigation by a ruse law firm or attorney who recruited chasers to act as confidential informants to go out and investigate soft tissue accidents that involved false or fake accidents. The two defendants, husband and wife, were charged with two counts of mail fraud and were convicted. Your Honors, the first issue that I want to present before this court is whether or not Judge Grady abused his discretion in deciding that the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege was proper in this case. Members of the court, the only facts in this case that showed that there was some kind of either fraud, accident, or scheme was the government's evidence presented against everybody but the Al Shaheens. The evidence in the motion in limine that the government tendered to the court was that James Whitner, who was an FBI agent, was running a ruse law firm. That's a given. We know that. That Mr. Johanna, David Johanna, was there working as a confidential informant to go find people to be involved in fake accidents. That Tidy O'Shana knew that there were fake accidents going on. That the Davids, whose car was used in the accident that involved the Al Shaheens, knew that there was a scheme to have a fake accident. No evidence whatsoever was put forth by the government prior to the beginning of this trial that the Al Shaheens had any knowledge. In fact, the only evidence that was presented showed that they had no knowledge that this was a fake accident. You have Tidy O'Shana, who happens to have an accidental run-in with David Johanna outside a medical office. Prior to that, Mr. Johanna worked with other chasers to get the Davids. This accidental meeting ends up with Mr. O'Shana bringing the Al Shaheens to this fake law office. And even during the initial meeting at the fake law office, Mr. O'Shana even says that this is a real accident. The issue then becomes is whether or not a prima facie case was made by the government to allow the testimony of Agent Whitmer, which were attorney-client privileged, to be introduced in the trial. The government just failed to put any evidence forward that would show that the Al Shaheens, both husband and wife, had knowledge that there was a fake accident or a staged accident involved. And therefore, by allowing this evidence in, it violated the attorney-client privilege, which is held by the Al Shaheens, to allow this testimony in, which was an abuse of discretion and an error.
Relative to the accident, when did they meet with the attorney?
It was approximately at least the first meeting between the confidential informant who worked for the attorney happened 4 days after the accident. Tidy O'Shana had taken the Al Shaheens to a doctor who Johanna was going to his office to record the doctor. They happened to have a chance run-in after the accident had already taken place 4 days earlier. It was Tidy O'Shana who then told David Johanna, the confidential informant, I'll bring this case to your lawyer. And it was a couple days after that the Al Shaheens went to the undercover attorney's office.
And what did they do at the doctor's office?
They were there. They had originally gone to the hospital to get checkup by emergency room after the accident. And after that, they had follow-up visits with a doctor in their neighborhood after Tidy O'Shana told them to go to another doctor just to have follow-up. But members of this court, Tidy O'Shana and Mr. Johanna did not even meet for the first time regarding anything to do with the Al Shaheens or anything to be involved in these fake auto accidents until 4 days after the accident. So Tidy O'Shana could not even have been involved in the scheme to stage this fake accident. We know for a fact that Davids, whose car was used in the accident, had knowledge of it. We knew that Carney Karimian, who also knew Mr. Johanna, had knowledge of it, and we knew Johanna had knowledge of it. Your Honors, if you look at even the testimony of James Whitner during trial, he testifies on cross-examination that he doesn't even know whether or not it's a staged accident. He knew the Davids were involved because he looked at the Davids' insurance policy before the accident even took place. So at best, their main star witness, who is the FBI agent, who is the undercover attorney making these false claims, the one who mails in the claim for the money, says that he doesn't even know whether or not it's a staged accident or whether or not the Al-Shaheens knew it was a staged accident. There are just no facts to support that they had knowledge, and therefore the crime fraud exception should not apply. Your Honor, I see my 5 minutes is up at this time. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal. Mr. Tunick will be addressing some of the issues, the other issues that we have raised.
Mr. Tunick.
Your Honor's counsel, my name is James Tunick, and I represent Haifa Al-Shaheen. Your Honors, Judge Grady committed reversible error when he denied the entrapment jury instruction. And this court has consistently affirmed the principle that a defendant in a criminal case is entitled to have the jury consider any theory of the defense which is supported by the law and which has some foundation in the evidence. And that's United States v. Briscoe. This court has consistently affirmed that principle. When Judge Grady denied the entrapment instruction, he stated the following. Now let's assume that you've established one government inducement. I don't see any evidence of lack of predisposition. It's difficult to have that without the testimony of the defendants. In essence, he eviscerated the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. He almost inferred that defendants would have to testify in order to give the entrapment defense. But the evidence, there was sufficient evidence to give the entrapment defense through the cross-examinations and the testimony of the government witnesses. Specifically, there was no evidence that the Al-Shaheens ever engaged in this type of activity on any other occasion. Second, they had no criminal background. Third, they were offered substantial money up front. They were offered substantial money by the agent who went by the name of Kent, who was the lawyer. And fourth, the government agent actually committed an element of the mail fraud offense. He actually did the mailing. He mailed the settlement papers, and he actually sent a letter to the insurance company to receive the checks. So the government agent induced an element of the offense and actually committed an element of the offense. He did the mailing. So there was sufficient evidence regarding inducement. And it was clear that that fact alone.
You think your client would have been better off with an entrapment defense given? I mean, your main defense was you didn't commit the crime.
Correct.
An entrapment defense assumes that all of the elements of the crime have been committed. And when the Supreme Court held that a defendant has the privilege of making an inconsistent, innocent, and entrapment defense, it also recognized that you might as well plead guilty. Because anybody who says, both my client didn't do it, and if I did, he was entrapped, has effectively pleaded guilty.
Well, Judge, I disagree with that, because clearly from the jury verdict, they would have been better off if the entrapment defense was given, and that would have been formed a major basis of the argument in this case. Just the fact that the government agent did the mailing in this case, an element of the crime before this court, distinguishes it from the cases cited by the United States, United States v. Evans.
That would be a basis for saying he didn't do it, but it wouldn't be a basis for saying he was entrapped.
I think that it shows the inducement. The court has consistently held that.
I don't think you understand. An entrapment defense requires the defendant to stand up and concede that he committed the elements of the offense.
Judge.
But you didn't want to do that.
Well, you can, as you know, you can take the alternative position if you
don't. Yes, you can.
If you don't believe.
I don't know a single federal judge who thinks that a defendant is better off telling a jury, I didn't do it, and oh, by the way, I also did do it, in the same mouth.
Your Honor, with all due respect,
it's not a very easy position.
A federal judge doesn't decide the proper defense for their clients. It's decided by the defense counsel
and their
clients.
That's true, although after this defense is made, we will decide the ineffective assistance claim.
Well, Judge, an argument put forth regarding entrapment, and there was evidence. There's sufficient evidence in the record to give that jury instruction. It's up to the counsel and the clients to decide whether they want to go that route. And clearly, it would have been a better route to go, given the jury verdict. There's also the government cites to also set several characteristics that to look at the character reputation of the defendant, the suggestion of criminal activity made by the government, and the nature of the inducement. And there was all those were all factors. Testimony was elicited regarding all those factors. There was no criminal background. There was no evidence that that Al-Shaheen's engaged in criminal activity like this before. It should have been allowed to argue that they were entrapped in this case. The agent acted as an attorney. They also had a chaser who was a government informant. There should have been an entrapment defense given. A rational jury could have inferred the FBI by setting up a fake law firm, going into the community, and to find participants in a fraud scheme, paying them up front, committing an element of offense, was entrapment. A rational jury could have found that, Your Honors.
When they paid him up front, what was the transaction?
I think it was like $4,000 was paid up front at the first visit at the attorney's office.
The attorney paid him $4,000.
Exactly.
And they accepted $4,000.
There was a $1,500 check and a $2,500 check issued to the Al-Shaheens. I believe it totaled $4,000 on the first visit with the attorney.
Is that what they would expect him to hire an attorney to?
I don't believe it. I think there was evidence elicited that was done in other fake accident cases, but I don't think that was standard practice of any sort. I think it actually violates the ethical canons for an attorney to give a client money up front in a pursuant to a loan agreement. I think that was also testimony that was elicited at trial. I just want to make a brief comment about the sentencing issue. Both of these individuals were enhanced because of the demand letter that was sent by the fake attorney, by the FBI agent Kent. There was no reasonable person would think that the intended loss would be based on a demand letter. No insurance company settles a case based on the initial demand letter. It should have been the enhancement, the sentencing guideline calculation should have been based on the actual loss in this case. That would have been probably the intended loss. The demand letter just sets the basis for the negotiations. Clearly, an insurance company will not settle prior to a lawsuit based on the initial demand letter. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. West.
May it please the court. Your Honor, appellants argue that the district court abused its discretion in admitting the testimony of FBI agent James Whitmer. Your Honor, appellants did not walk into this law office expecting to create an attorney-client relationship. They walked in looking to recruit an accomplice to a crime. The sole purpose of this visit to the law office was to further the submission of fraudulent medical bills to the American Family Insurance Company so as to fraudulently obtain insurance proceeds for treatments that did not occur, for non-existent medical injuries, from an accident that was staged. This investigation had certain protections in place that would ensure that only claims that came into the office were those that were fraudulently submitted. There was no legitimate attorney. Because of these protections, because of many of the other aspects of the testimony, and I won't get into the level of facts that appellants have raised, but there was a significant amount of testimony presented at trial regarding the conversations among various witnesses in the case and conversations with appellants that all signify the level of fraud that was going on here and that no attorney-client relationship was intended.
What went on before, as far as the appellants are concerned, before they met with the attorney? What evidence was there of their knowledge or their intent or whatever they anticipated participation in this? It's after, maybe even before and after the accident.
Your Honor, Johanna,
wreck, whatever you call it.
Johanna did meet with Karamian, another chaser in the case prior, who had relationships with the hitters, those who crashed into the car. There was a discussion of who these people would be, the David family, which car would be used, whether that it would be more appropriate for the son to be the hitter rather than the father, because the father had already had prior insurance claims submitted along this policy. There were conversations between Johanna and Oshana as well. Johanna had Robert and Michael David themselves testified regarding the fraudulent accident in this case. And further, at the July 21 meeting itself, there's significant conversations in Arabic and English, both of which appellants did understand There are some phrases in Assyrian which they did not, but much of the conversation they could understand and signifies knowledge of the fraud in this case.
Did the Elshans have a record in this activity? Had they been arrested for this activity, kind of activity in the past?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. On the second issue of entrapment, the evidence showed overwhelmingly the defendants had already committed many of the steps of the fraud scheme before ever meeting Attorney Wimmer, illustrating no government inducement or predisposition to engage in the conduct. They'd agreed to take part in the stage accident on July 14, 1997. They falsified police reports regarding the accident.
Falsified what?
Police reports. They filed a false police report that the accident had occurred.
They knew. What was their physical involvement in the wreck?
According to the police report, Your Honor, they were hit by another vehicle after that vehicle ran through a stop sign.
And what, did the evidence ever come out what really happened?
Your Honor, the party who was in the other vehicle testified that the accident that they were not involved in the accident.
The appellants were not.
Not appellants, but the other party to the accident testified that Robert and Michael David testified that they were not in a vehicle that hit appellants. The appellants lied to doctors at St. Francis Hospital regarding the accident. They initiated unnecessary medical treatment at Rogers Park Medical Clinic regarding the 21 future visits. And they relayed that they were upset with the amount of 1 in 3 times of the medicals. Your Honor, no entrapment defense was appropriate here. The district court properly refused the tender jury instruction. The third issue, the advice of counsel defense. So district court stated, there's no evidence here that Attorney Kent told these defendants that it was legal to defraud the insurance company or to have a staged accident. Defendants failed to show any evidence upon which their good faith reliance on advice of counsel could be established. They've shown neither that they provided to Whitmer all material information known to them, namely that the accident was staged, or that they relied in good faith on Whitmer's advice. Under this standard, the tender jury instruction was not appropriate and was properly refused by the district court. The fourth issue, Your Honor, the district court did act within its discretion by denying defendants' motion for an evidentiary hearing into the extrajudicial comment. There was no evidence here that the third party attempted to influence the jury or that anything was said back to the juror in response to the comment that the jury was having a hard time reaching a verdict. Defendants need some conceivable theory of prejudice here to require a hearing. None is evident from the briefing or...
Was the jury instructed not to talk about the deliberations to third parties?
Your Honor, the jurors did receive the standard instruction regarding what is and is not evidence in the case. I do not...
That's not my question.
I do not believe so.
Not evidence.
I do not believe so.
You don't think that it was? Isn't
Excuse
that a
me.
Perfectly normal thing the jury is told?
That is correct, Judge.
Well, did you find out whether the jury was told that or not? See, the reason I ask this question is because the district judge, after it's brought out that the jury has indeed talked to a stranger about the deliberations, says, well, I'm not going to hold a hearing because there's no evidence that the juror has violated any instruction. That implies the jury has not been instructed, which would imply that the judge has not given the standard instructions in it, or for that matter, a civil case.
Judge, and I have found the instructions here. The judge said, anything that you may or have seen or heard outside the courtroom is not evidence and must be entirely disregarded.
No, I'm not asking about evidence from outside in. I'm asking information from inside out.
That's correct. No, I do not believe that instruction was given.
You don't think that instruction was given? You have looked and you found that it was not given, or you just didn't look?
I do not recall at this point, Your Honor.
You don't recall whether you looked?
I looked. I do not believe it was given.
All right. So you're representing that you looked and did not find it?
Yes, Your Honor. On the final point, Your Honor, the district court properly applied the 6-point loss amount enhancement under the sentencing guidelines. Finding a loss amount is a question of fact, reviewed for clear error only. Claims submitted to the American Family Insurance Company totaled $52,414. As this intended loss amount exceeded $30,000, a six-level loss enhancement applied under Guideline Section 2B1.1 was appropriate and was applied. The guidelines and case law require only that the sentencing judge make a reasonable estimate of the loss. Agent Whitmer testified regarding that he received a call from appellants from Haifa al-Shaheen that he informed her of the $52,414 demand letter, confirming that the plan all along had been to seek settlement of the amount of three times medicals. When the al-Shaheens came to the law office to receive the final checks from Whitmer, they adopted this settlement and lost the amount. Your Honor, for these reasons on each of these five issues, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm the convictions and sentences of defendants Haifa al-Shaheen and Riyad al-Shaheen. Thank you.
Mr. Shannon?
Members of this court, and Judge, specifically addressing the questions you asked about the facts, there are no facts to show that the al-Shaheens knew that this was a staged accident. The only evidence put forth is that everybody else involved knew. There was damage to their vehicle. It was hit in the passenger's door and the driver's door. After that, they went to the hospital. They called the police. The police came to the hospital, and a report was made. Pictures were taken. All evidence shows that this was a real accident, at least as they were involved.
Well, so the police report says they were involved in an accident. Somebody hit their car.
Who ran a stop sign.
Yeah, and they filled out that accident report.
The police,
and there was no evidence after that to say that didn't happen.
Correct. There was no evidence after that to show that that did not happen. They called the police after they were hit, after a car ran a stop sign. They waited for the police there. Then they go to the hospital because the police didn't come. They call the police again. The police come to the hospital while they're receiving medical treatment from ER doctors. Sometime after that, approximately 4 to 5 days later, is when they are at a medical clinic getting follow-up care. When Tidy O'Shana runs into David Johanna, who is the confidential informant who works with Whitmer, O'Shana states there, "I have an accident. I'll bring it to your office." In the meeting that is tape recorded, in the attorney's office, even Mr. O'Shana says, "This is a real accident." And there's conversations, Judge, during that meeting that take place in Assyrian, which the record is clear our clients do not understand. It is those conversations that are between Johanna and O'Shana talking about how they're going to make money off other people, how they're going to stage more accidents. The al-Shaheens couldn't understand any of that. And Judge Easterbrook, addressing your issue of whether the instruction was given, whether they should not talk to him, it was given. It was given in the beginning of the trial and at the end of the trial.
I can't believe that it was not given.
Judge, it was given. I was one of the trial lawyers in this case. I think I was the only trial lawyer in this room that was on that case. That instruction was given, and it was violated.
Did anybody argue to Judge Grady when he said, when he gave as his reason for not holding a hearing, the fact that the juror was not violating any instruction in talking to third parties? Anybody point out to Judge Grady that the juror was indeed violating a judicial order, and therefore one might want to find out what other orders the juror was violating?
Judge, we briefed it. We weren't really given an oral argument on this issue. When we came to court after we briefed it, it was denied. I mean, nobody knows even what the statements were made. There was never an inquiry as to what...
I'm not really interested in that. As you might be able to tell from my question, the question is, what duties does a judge have when he discovers that a juror is violating his instructions?
Judge, I believe the case law is clear. It says the judge has a duty to inquire as to, number one, what the violation is, why it was violated, and what the context of the violation was.
I would appreciate it if the parties would, if you would say, just submit a letter informing us where in the record we can find that if you don't have that at your fingertips.
Judge, I don't have it at my fingertips, but I could submit something by Wednesday of next week at the latest.
One or the other of you is seriously confused. You say it is. Mr. West says he looks and it's not there. We really need to know.
Judge, I will have that submitted by Wednesday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Is there any evidence of actual injuries in this accident?
There was evidence, an ER doctor testified that the day of the accident, he believed that there was some spinal problems with Mr. Al-Shaheen and that Ms. Al-Shaheen had some medical conditions because of the accident. It was he testified at trial, he was a defense witness, the day of the accident, that he did believe there was medical problems with both the all three of the Al-Shaheens. It was his recommendation to get follow-up treatment. If there's no further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement. We will look forward to being brought up to date on the record. Our next case for argument this morning.